Governor Doug Ducey yesterday called for Arizona to become to the sharing economy what Texas is to oil. Can we hit that amount of digital pay dirt?
If we're talking about founding sharing economy-based companies here in Phoenix as our core metric, I think we most certainly can achieve that.
I'm Mark Brody. Also today on the show, changes could be coming for the company that runs the University of Phoenix. How clay could be a key to killing harmful bacteria. Could enhanced graphics affect Arizona's tourism? And a futurist on what the future will need.
For me, imagination is the number one most underutilized tool in business, in education, in engineering, you name it.
Plus, native artists young and old working together, and a new record with an obsolete sound. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 64 degrees, few degrees cooler than average. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 40. It's sunny and 62 right now at KJZZ. Ski resorts on national forest land now will have to prove they have sufficient water supplies. From the Arizona Science Desk, Melissa Siveny reports on the new regulation.
The rule arose out of concerns about limited water resources in the West. Jim Bedwell, spokesperson for the U.S. Forest Service, says it's designed to protect winter recreation.
We know that communities have built their economies around it, that lifestyles are built around it. We felt it was in the best public interest to sustain those water rights with the ski area operation.
An older version of the rule required ski resorts to transfer their water rights to the federal government. The Forest Service abandoned that plan after a lawsuit in 2012. Instead, resorts will have to document long-term, secure water supplies when they apply for or renew their permits. More than 100 ski resorts operate on national forest lands. In Arizona, that includes Arizona Snowbowl, Elk Ridge, and Mount Lemmon. In Flagstaff, I'm Melissa Siveny.
A state appellate court has ruled it is constitutional for Arizona to require some people on probation to pay a monthly fee, but not others. The Court of Appeals today denied an appeal by a Maricopa County defendant ordered to pay a monthly fee while on unsupervised probations for drug convictions in Superior Court. The defendant argued his rights to protection under the law were violated because people convicted in justice or magistrate courts don't have to pay fees for unsupervised probation. But the court ruled the law on probation fees is constitutional because it has a, quote, conceivable rational basis for helping pay for services provided by probation officers. The court also said it's reasonable to distinguish between courts because some don't provide probation services. The Wall Street Journal is reporting a private equity firm is in advanced talks to buy Apollo Education Group, the parent company of the University of Phoenix. The news comes as Apollo announced its first quarter earnings. I'm joined by KJZZ senior business correspondent Christina Estes. Christina, what do we know about this possible sale?
The Wall Street Journal reports the deal could be worth about $1 billion. The Apollo Education Group released a statement yesterday that said its board of directors is exploring strategic alternatives which could lead to a change of control of the company.
So we know the University of Phoenix has seen revenue and student enrollment drop. What are their latest numbers?
Well, when you compare the first quarter this year to the first quarter last year, Apollo's revenue is down nearly $130 million, and new student enrollment is down 15,000. At its peak, the company reported about 480,000 enrolled students. Today, it's about 180,000, so we're talking a difference of 300,000 students.
Now, one time, University of Phoenix really dominated the online education industry. Today, obviously a lot more competition. How has that impacted University of Phoenix and Apollo Group?
No doubt the influx of schools offering online courses and degrees has impacted the Phoenix-based company, but so has increased federal scrutiny. A series of government investigations found the Apollo Group and other for-profit schools had low graduation rates, high student debt, much of it from federal loans, and not particularly strong job prospects for graduates. The Department of Defense even put the University of Phoenix on probation last year and barred it from recruiting students on military bases.
So what does the future hold, do you think, for the Apollo Group then?
In its statement, the company says it will continue its transformation plan. Now, that includes improving graduation rates and job prospects and keeping its focus on people who want to earn college degrees and also need flexible schedules. The company also says it's looking to increase its global footprint. Right now, it has partners in India, Germany, Brazil, and other countries. Of course, things could change if the company is sold.
That's KJZZ Senior Business Correspondent Christina Estes. Christina, thanks.
You're welcome.
In his State of the State address yesterday, Governor Doug Ducey said he wants Arizona to be to the sharing economy what Texas is to oil. To help facilitate that, he signed an executive order creating the Governor's Council on the Sharing Economy.
Its mission? Stop shackling innovation and instead put the cuffs on out-of-touch regulators. I want startups in the sharing economy to know California may not want you, but Arizona does.
The council will, among other things, develop recommendations for ways to improve the state's legal and regulatory structure for the state sharing economy. To get a sense of where Arizona stands now, I'm joined by Sydney Peck, director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU. And Sydney, what is Arizona's place in the sharing economy?
You know, it seems to be that we follow this pretty similarly with other trends, you know, that start in maybe some of the bigger cities that we're used to seeing things pop out of New York and Silicon Valley, Seattle, Austin, and we stick around in that kind of top 10 major city area. So I think we're fairly progressive across the country. And I, from what I see around me, a lot of millennials and my peers are really adapting to this new sharing economy, and I see a pretty significant amount of activity around it. As I travel and visit other places, you'll still see some cities who are, you know, barely becoming comfortable with something like an Uber. And so I would say we're right there in the top 10 cities. Again, that's not a scientific quote there, but we're fairly progressive.
Do you think that there would be more of these technology-type firms, sharing economy-type firms, starting here in Arizona, absent existing regulation and laws?
Well, I think anytime you reduce barriers to entry, be it regulation, policy, you're automatically going to get more innovation, more people trying new things. It's hard to say who's not trying something because of a current policy or regulation, but most certainly we will see more innovation anytime barriers are lowered.
Do you think that Arizona has the potential, as Governor Ducey said yesterday, to be to the sharing economy what Texas is to oil? I mean, is that a realistic expectation, or do we need to set our sights maybe a little bit lower?
Oh, we should never set our sights lower. I think that's fantastic. I think it's a really cool concept. That's harder to show a material metric for, right? I mean, it's easy to measure a place that might have more technology startups or a place that has high oil production. But if we're talking about founding sharing economy-based companies here in Phoenix as our core metric, I think we most certainly can achieve that. And as far as level of usage, I mean, being in a place where there's really high tourism, that's a great fit for a sharing economy because so much of it revolves around being in a new place or around new things or needing things when you don't have the stuff that you have when you're at home. I think it's incredible that he has given us this big thing to work towards, and I don't see why we can't.
How much of the effort to increase a region's technology startups or make Arizona more of a sharing economy kind of place is based on perception that people see Arizona as a good place for tech companies to be, as people see it as a stable place economically, politically, that sort of thing?
Everything's driven by perception. This is a big battle we face. I think I was actually just having this conversation with someone in my office earlier today that the way I see things, because I am lucky to live in the Phoenix metro area, is very different than the way someone may see it from the outside when they're only seeing national headlines. And so the responsibility on us is to make the national headlines about the things we want them to be about, because what we need is people talking about the incredible things that we're doing, not the things that are frustrating or even perceived incorrectly simply because of the way media may be treating a certain political topic.
Sydney Peck is the director of the Center for Entrepreneurship at the Carey School of Business at ASU. Sydney, thank you.
Thank you.
Arizona isn't the only place looking to incorporate the sharing economy into its overall economy. Ariella Cohen is the editor-in-chief for Next City, an online publication covering urban change and policy. Ariella, are there cities or states that are really doing this well now?
I think that there's a lot of cities that are grappling with how to regulate the sharing economy. And actually, I would say that no matter the size of the city or the kind of tech savviness of the citizenry, many cities are in the same boat because we have this butting up against of old regulation and new technology and new cultural attitudes about cars, about housing, about public space and private space. So if you look at a place like Jersey City, it's increasingly popular with tourists who are looking to stay in Manhattan but not wanting to pay Manhattan hotel prices. It's a smaller city, but it's increasingly attractive to people who have been priced out of Brooklyn or Manhattan. So they are seeing a huge rush on Airbnb. They're also seeing a huge rush on car sharing applications like Uber and Lyft. Meanwhile, Jersey City is a working class city, and there's a lot of pushing back from union workers, from the hotel industry. So, you know, Jersey City's mayor, Stephen Fulop, is introducing legislation at the same time as, like, much larger cities like San Francisco and New York across the river are also introducing legislation and having battles over the very same issues.
So you're finding that a lot of the issues that different cities are dealing with are basically the same. It sounds like it's new technology, new opportunities versus sort of what's been there and the industries that have been serving people for lots of years.
Exactly. And for many cities, hotel tax is a large source of revenue. What do you do when hotels are seeing their bookings drop because, you know, Susie Oracle is renting out her front room for $50 a night and she's not paying any taxes on that?
So how are cities trying to balance both continuing to get the revenue that they need to get, but also encouraging some of these new technology and technology firms to sprout up in their places?
Well, in many cities, people are experimenting with taxation. Airbnb has launched its own kind of defense, trying to say, you know, we are giving back to the community and we're creating income for individuals. And they're beginning to share some level of records with cities so that there's some accountability about taxing that income. And so I think it's a balancing act. They don't want to be giving away the farm, these cities, but at the same time, they want to make their cities appealing destinations for these companies and their employers.
Are there cities that have found that there is room for both sort of the traditional hotel taxi model, but also, you know, companies like Airbnb and Uber and Lyft? I mean, is there space for all of those different types of companies to be successful in a single place?
I think that they're going to have to be. The sharing economy isn't going away. I wouldn't even call it the sharing economy at this point. I would say, you know, there's not a great term for it, but, you know, the on-demand economy really is growing. It's going to continue to grow. People are using it. And their legacy industries like the taxi cabs and the hotels are going to have to adjust. I live in Philadelphia, and taxi cabs are protesting all the time against Uber and UberX, its peer driver program. At the same time, those companies are taking a larger and larger share of the market. So the taxis are developing their own apps, you know, and they're just trying to compete on a piece-by-piece basis. And so really, probably some of these industries should have been keeping up with technology a little bit earlier in many cases.
Ariella Cohen is editor-in-chief of the online publication Next City. Ariella, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Mexican drug kingpin El Chapo Guzman says he's the biggest trafficker in the world and uses submarines to deliver his contraband.
As you can imagine, the traffickers don't care so much for the comfort of the individuals working in their employment. The vessel itself is purpose-built to transport narcotics.
Just ahead, we'll go aboard a captured drug sub. Stay with us. It's the show. Good afternoon. Happy Tuesday to you. I'm Mark Brody. You're listening to the show on KJZZ. The show is a stream of curated stories from Phoenix, our region, and around the country. With the help of reporters and producers around the region and around the globe, we're mixing stories and news to keep you up to date and entertained. Sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 64 degrees. We had 61 for a high yesterday. 67 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows near 40. If you like today, you'll probably like the next couple of days. Sunny skies with highs in the low to mid 60s both tomorrow and Thursday, really continuing on into Friday and Saturday as well. Right now in Phoenix with relative humidity of 16%, sunny skies, 63 degrees at KJZZ at 219.
KJZZ is supported by Scottsdale Community College, offering a fast-track teacher post-baccalaureate program. You can be teaching and inspiring students in just 1 year. Learn more by emailing STEP at scottsdalecc.edu.
It's the show for Tuesday, January 12th. Along with the takeaways, John Hockenberry. Today, I'm Mark Brody.
The state of the union.
The state of our union.
State of the union.
My fellow Americans, the state of our union is
going to be fine.
Very, very public.
A complete disaster.
A little more honest.
Business as usual.
It's the State of the Union address. You can hear it tonight. The yearly constitutionally mandated communication from the White House to Congress that is since President Woodrow Wilson evolved into the theatrical monster truck battle between the White House and Capitol Hill. It's live on all the networks, streamed to the entire world. You can count the applause lines at home. There's no Powerball jackpot for getting it right yet, but there will be a large audience, as this is Barack Obama's final State of the Union address. He's down to his last 343 days in office. Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian and professor at Rice University, says the online audience is now a significant part of the evolution of this State of the Union event.
Well, for one thing, it has much more of an internet value now. People watch it on their home computers, not just television. But I think mainly that he's kind of kept the tradition going of it being a big moment. We don't just listen to the president's words, but we watch the body language of everybody in the room. And he's really, I think, mastered the art of bringing outside guests in to come and stand up, somebody who is a mother who is lost a child due to gun violence or a soldier from the war in Iraq or Afghanistan. This kind of paying homage to Americans. Ronald Reagan really started doing that, and I think Barack Obama's perfected the art of it.
What moments stand out to you as you look back?
Well, on President Obama's State of the Union, I think the one that really sticks in my mind is in 2012 when he got to go and say the war in Iraq is over.
For the first time in 9 years, there are no Americans fighting in Iraq.
After all, he got elected in 2008, largely on being this anti-war senator from Illinois, and he said, we're going to get out of the war in Iraq, and he did. And the fact that he could announce the ending of a war really at a State of the Union, I thought that was a dramatic moment.
But, you know, it's possible that based on what's happened since, that the war in Iraq is over moment will be remembered as a kind of smaller mission accomplished statement on the part of the president.
Well, there's some truth to that. Look, basically, these State of the Union addresses are report cards. Here's how the country's doing. Most of the time, we're trying to say positive things. President Obama will want to say, you know, America's back on track. He's going to remind people of the Great Recession, how awful it was when he was president, and how much better the economy is doing right now. Another one that jumps out at me is when he was able at a State of the Union to talk about gay rights. Actually, was the first president to use the words transgender and gay, lesbian, all in a State of the Union address.
That's why we defend free speech and advocate for political prisoners and condemn the persecution of women or religious minorities or people who are lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender. We do these things not only because they are the right thing to do, but because ultimately they will make us safer.
That was a seminal moment. He had previously talked about Stonewall in an inaugural address, but to do it in a State of the Union gave it a kind of a gravitas.
If the events of the last year and a half are any guide, we will see a president invigorated and engaged and seeming to enjoy himself as president in these last months, in a way that we really haven't seen for most of these 8 years, wouldn't you say?
I think that's right. You know, I saw some media outlets that have been showing the aging of Barack Obama, how his hair has turned a little gray. But really, he's weathered the presidency pretty well when you consider how beaten and battered most of these guys get. He still has his gait. He still seems to be in perfect shape. He seems on top of his game. He's has a great intellectual acumen. So this is a president that's going to leave office having a lot of years ahead of him. As ex-president, one would hope and think. I think we need to look at this State of the Union as what's it going to tell us about his post-presidency? Because this is a president in recent months that is staking out ground on two key areas, controlling of gun violence and having, you know, a registration list of gun owners in America, and climate change.
Douglas Brinkley, professor of history at Rice University, is also an author and fellow at the James Baker Institute for Public Policy. Doug, thanks so much.
Thank you.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. You can hear President Obama's final State of the Union tonight at 7 right here on KJZZ. The notorious Mexican drug lord Joaquin Guzman, or El Chapo, is back in a high-security prison awaiting extradition to the U.S. Lawyers say the process could take as long as a year. In the recent and controversial interview El Chapo gave to the actor Sean Penn, he boasted that he supplies more drugs than anyone in the world. He also added, quote, "I have a fleet of submarines, airplanes, trucks, and boats." So how does a drug cartel get and use submarines? The BBC's Helena Merriman has more.
We did a lot of things growing up as a family on the water.
This is Lieutenant Commander Devin Brennan. He grew up in a military family and spent most weekends in their boat on the Atlantic. Out on the water as a teenager, he was transfixed, above all, by the Coast Guard.
But I do remember hearing the alarm go off and watching the men run down and jump on the boat and race off to go save someone. And I always remember that as an endearing image of a job that I wanted to be a part of.
He now oversees the Coast Guard's anti-drug policies in Washington, D.C. And so it was that on September the 1st, he found himself monitoring an operation that turned out to be one of the most successful Coast Guard drug seizures in American history. It started with a routine patrol along the coast of Guatemala.
The first message that we heard was an indication from the maritime patrol aircraft that they believed they had a contact. So as soon as you heard those words, your blood pressure comes up a little bit and you start to get excited.
The patrol aircraft had spotted something strange in the water. So the Coast Guard launched their largest ship and a helicopter to look for it. As they drew closer, smaller speedboats joined them.
To go sneak up behind the vessel. And then we were able to surprise them enough to get them to stop.
What they found was astonishing. A long, oval, turquoise vessel, almost entirely hidden under the water. It was a semi-submersible, what's often described as a narco-submarine.
So if you were just looking at the vessel, there'll be a foot of the vessel sticking above the water, painted various shades of blue to blend in with the water. So even that portion that's above the water, when you're looking at it from an airplane or a ship, is incredibly hard to detect, even a few hundred feet away from it.
It's why a find like this is so rare. The Coast Guard stopped the narco sub and arrested the traffickers. A video then shows the Coast Guard on top of the sub. They lift a hatch, and a camera reveals what's inside. A tiny cabin.
As you can imagine, the traffickers don't care so much for the comfort of the individuals working in their employment. The vessel itself is purpose-built to transport narcotics, so the vast majority of the space is left for the actual narcotics. So what is left over for these crew, which in general are around four persons, is very, very cramped quarters, maybe the size of a bed.
And this cocoon, for a few weeks, is their home.
No toilet facilities, no cooking facilities, so what they bring is, you know, what they can just eat readily there and relieve themselves in areas of the vessel that is open to them. So, and then you're also exposed to not only the narcotics, but also the diesel engines that operate these things predominantly.
The Coast Guard camera moves further into the cabin. And there, amongst the gas tanks, pipes, and navigation equipment, is the cocaine, parceled up in green, orange, and purple bags, wedged into every corner. 7 tons of it, worth $227 million. So much, he says, that it's a wonder the narco sub didn't sink. In fact, it's this calculation that's the most hazardous for the traffickers, making the narco sub heavy enough that it sits low in the water, avoiding detection, but not so heavy that it sinks.
The fact that they are so low to the waterline and filled with so much narcotics that weighs them down, there's the chance any time for these smugglers that the vessel could sink and capsize, and they'd be trapped inside the vessel and, you know, to their own demise. So it is an incredibly dangerous venture.
Right now, there may be a handful of narco subs somewhere on the ocean floor with millions of dollars worth of cocaine or heroin inside, as well as dead smugglers. Meanwhile, the cartels are trying to build the next generation of these subs.
They are clearly trying to get to the point where they can have a fully submersible vessel, nothing above the surface of the water. And that would be a game changer for us to try to detect something of that nature.
That was Lieutenant Commander Devin Brennan of the U.S. Coast Guard, ending our report from the BBC's Helena Merriman. Arizona is known for its sunshine, but the virtual reality video game Arizona Sunshine is a less, well, sunny look at the state. Players step into a, quote, zombie apocalypse and battle for survival across, quote, a blistering hot post-apocalyptic Arizona. To get a sense of how real virtual reality games can be for the places in which they're set, I'm joined by Michael Evans, an associate professor in the College of Education at North Carolina State University. He studies video games. Michael, with better graphics and overall technology, how does that change what players know about the places in which these games are set?
Certainly, what the player interacts with immediately are the aesthetics of the game, the look, the feel, the oral components, whether it's sound design or sound effects. And I think the more coordinated and sophisticated those are, the more that one could be motivated or engaged by that. And I do think that, you know, given my research and experience working in the K-12 population, that the expectations are quite high now, and they start much earlier now.
With the interaction level and, I guess, the experience more real, for lack of a better word, does that kind of blur players' perceptions of what is actually real and what is maybe virtually real?
I realize that, you know, there are a lot of issues with the potential that players might have difficulty sort of distinguishing between these virtual, let's say, virtual playgrounds and, let's say, real playgrounds or the real world. I will say, though, from my work, I'm finding that, you know, K-12 students and moving down even into late elementary, they're quite sophisticated using these technologies. I don't think we should let them interact with them without some sort of supervision or education. But I do see that with that, if they have the right supports, they do or can distinguish between these high fidelity, high resolution environments and, you know, the world outside or what we call in the real world.
So in a situation with a game like this virtual reality, this Arizona Sunshine game, would you be concerned at all that gamers would be playing this game and, you know, see what they're seeing based in Arizona? That it sounds like you don't think that would necessarily blur somebody's perception of what Arizona is about or what any place is about, you know, regardless of where a game might be set.
Well, I think even with text-based, you know, novels or books, you know, you can create very fantastic and rich descriptions. You know, that's the story element. And you can, you know, try to perceive what a foreign environment's like. So, you know, if you've never been to Arizona and you only encounter it through this game and it's a fictional treatment of Arizona, you may think that, well, there are some relationship there. I do think that with the Arizona Sunshine, because it's a zombie genre game, that I don't think most players would think that Arizona is overrun by zombies, but with the photorealism, they may start to appreciate the background or the environment of what Arizona is like. And where the issue might lie is that this is only, you know, a section or subsection of an area of Arizona. And where I would want to be cautious and be educative is to say that, you know, understand that this is not all of Arizona, that, you know, this is an area. You know, the same issues may have occurred, you know, looking at Hollywood films.
Do you think that it's possible that with these interactive video games that more and more are being set in specific places, if that's combined with the education that you talked about earlier, Is that a way, do you think, to sort of expand people's cultural understandings of places that maybe they haven't been or don't know much about?
Absolutely. And point in fact is that I'm working with some folks here at NC State where we're actually trying to explore some of that, looking at how citizens in Ethiopia and Africa are dealing with water shortages, much like what's happening in California. We are looking at virtual reality technologies such as the Oculus Rift. So I do think that if we have an educational initiative, we can take advantage of these in terms of the technologies and also in terms of the media, which are our video games. So I'm optimistic, let's say, that we are approaching a time where we can take advantage of this to the benefit of our youth and educate them about, either other places within the continental United States or maybe across the globe.
Michael Evans is an associate professor in the College of Education at NC State. Coming up on the show, a Nashville artist brings his obsolete sound to Arizona.
There's not a lot of commercial consideration given when we're working on stuff. We don't write 2-minute, 3-minute pop songs.
A conversation with folk singer David Rawlings. That's just ahead. It's the show. Good afternoon. This is the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Quick check of Valley traffic. There's a vehicle fire on the 51 northbound at Cactus. You want to watch out for that. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 64 degrees, 3 degrees warmer than yesterday, 3 degrees cooler than average. It'll be clear tonight with overnight lows right around 40. Sunny skies, 64 for a high tomorrow, 63 on Thursday. More of the same right on through the beginning of the weekend. Around the state right now, 40 degrees in Flagstaff, 51 in Prescott, 63 degrees in Tucson. Here in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 16%, sunny and 63 degrees at KJZZ at 235.
KJZZ is supported by Subaru Superstore of Chandler, a local family-owned and operated dealership, featuring the 2016 Forester with 32 mpg and enhanced safety features for anything life throws at you. Online at shopsubaru.com.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Clay has long thought to contain medicinal properties, prompting people to take mud baths at Southwest resorts or even ingesting small amounts. But new research suggests a particular type of clay containing certain elements may directly kill harmful bacteria. From the Arizona Science Desk, KJZZ's Andrew Bernier reports.
Unfortunately, much of the red clay abundant in the Southwest, which contains oxidized iron, giving it a rust color, isn't the medicinal clay. Rather, ASU researcher Linda Williams says green and blue clays have chemically reduced iron, something bacteria needs little bits of to survive.
So what you see exposed at the surface may be a red-looking clay in Arizona, but deep underground, it might become more reduced. And what we found is that it is the reduced iron that becomes soluble when you add water to the clay. That, along with aluminum, attacks human pathogens.
Williams says when the reduced iron clays touch bacteria, the iron and aluminum act in tandem to invade the cell, much like a Trojan horse.
These clays do a double attack, using the aluminum to damage proteins in the cell wall that opens up the pores and allows excess iron to go into these cells. It's causing an oxidation reaction inside the cell and causes damage to the interior proteins.
Fortunately, human cells get mineral nutrients and oxygen from blood, while bacteria cells are dependent on external sources, which is why human cells are not hurt from clay applications. During initial tests, Williams found the clays were performing better than antibiotics.
They were killing antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and bacteria that have no antibiotic cure. So clearly they were working by a different mechanism than normal antibiotics. And so if we can know this mechanism, we can synthesize it to make hopefully a better drug.
Which is one of the hopes of Enriqueta Barrera from the National Science Foundation, who funded the research.
To be able to understand how it is that it promotes healing with a fast application of clays, this has the potential to have a practical application. But I think that with more trials and more experiments, it could become applicable, maybe in commercial.
Barrera says the foundation funded the research because its interdisciplinary approach lets scientists better understand the natural formation of the clays and its toxicity to bacteria.
You borrow from one discipline and the other, and you begin to emerge with a new image of how things operate in nature. And there is actually lots of natural substances that are used in medicine, but sometimes the medical profession doesn't really know how it operates.
By merging geochemistry with health, it may take soaking in a mud bath from a resort activity to an important treatment against antibiotic-resistant bacteria. For the show, I'm Andrew Bernier in Phoenix.
Nobody knows for sure what the future holds, but some people may have a better sense than others. Take Brian David Johnson, for example. He's the new futurist in residence at ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination, as well as a professor of practice in the School for the Future of Innovation in Society. So, Brian, what does the job of futurist in residence entail?
Well, as a futurist, it's my job to look 10 to 15 years out and model what it will feel like to be a human and live in the future. And I've done this for the past 20 years with large corporations, with the governments, with militaries, with small startups, with trade organizations and universities. So as a futurist in residence at Arizona State University, I'm going to be working with the students, working with the faculty, working with really the broader community, trying to bring that foresight and vision and see how I can put it to best effect.
What kinds of modeling or metrics do you use? Because it seems like somebody could just sort of gaze into a crystal ball and call themselves a futurist. I assume that's not what you're doing.
Definitely not. I do not have a crystal ball. You'll find I'm a very pragmatic futurist. I'm really what's called an applied futurist. What I do is I take a mixture of social science, which is ethnographic and social science studies. I use technical research. I use economic and trend data, and then I also use a really wide swath of expert interviews. And I take all of that, and I look 10 to 15 years out and work with groups. So I would never be so arrogant as to say that I know everything about the future. Really, it's my job to work with people to model the future and say, well, what is the future we want, and what is the future we want to avoid, and then what are the very specific next steps we need to take today, tomorrow, maybe 5 years from now to get to those futures.
Are there any specific projects that you'll be working on, either with your colleagues or with your students?
Yeah, there's two projects that I'm really excited about. The first is called What's the Future of the American Dream? And this is a passion project of mine. It was started as a personal journey, really starting to look at really what's the future of the American dream. What do we see for ourselves? And it's a project that I'm so excited about because it really can never be answered. I can never get it right. But the only way that I can get it less wrong is to talk to more and more people. And then my other project is something called the 21st Century Robot Project. And that uses science fiction to model and build open source 3D printable robots. And the goal there is to really get it into schools, to get as many young minds imagining, building, and programming robots as possible.
What do you think is the benefit of having robotics and having robots in more schools than there are now?
Well, certainly that we need more engineers. You know, we have a lack of engineers. As we look out into the futures, we know we're going to need more engineers, and we're going to need more diverse engineers. So the 21st Century Robot Project starts in the imagination. It says that all engineering, all robotics begins in the imagination first. We have to imagine a future. We have to imagine what these robots would be, and then we can teach people the engineering, the hardware, the software to go about and make that happen.
You mentioned the word imagination, and I would think that that would be a fairly significant component of what you do. Do you find that students coming up have enough imagination or are taught to use their imagination enough?
We're at a really interesting time in technology and in society. We're in a time where our science and our technology has progressed to the point where what we build is only constrained by the limits of our imagination. And so for me, imagination is the number one most underutilized tool in business, in education, in engineering, you name it. I believe it's not valued enough, we don't support it enough, and we don't use it enough. And so when I go into universities and when I go into schools and talk to students, I encourage them to use it. I do find that they have not been dampened down. And so for them, they have, I think, a much more boundless imagination, but they need to be given the permission and they need to be given the platform to use it, and then also the skills to be able to build whatever they can imagine.
Brian David Johnson is the futurist in residence at ASU's Center for Science and the Imagination. Brian, thank you.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Mark.
Phoenix currently has 10 sister cities, but it's been several years since it's added a new one. Among the places the city is considering as its 11th sister city is one in India, after members of Phoenix's Indian American community expressed an interest in building that relationship. Paula West is director of Phoenix's International Relations Office and president and CEO of Phoenix Sister Cities. Paula, how do cities get chosen to become sister cities with Phoenix?
Well, historically speaking, for various reasons, there may have been a company who was really interested in having Phoenix connected with wherever the headquarters of their company was. It may be that there is culture, you know, that there is a community group that they are interested in a relationship, and that would be Ennis, Ireland. We have a large Irish-American community. It can be for university reasons, population, economic development. Economic opportunities are something as we move forward in establishing more sister city relationships. We want to make sure there are economic opportunities between the two cities.
What kinds of economic opportunities can develop? I mean, obviously, there's sort of a cultural exchange, and
right.
It's nice to have on the signs in both places
sure.
that, you know, you have a relationship with the city. But from a pragmatic standpoint, how do these help companies and the economies?
Well, I can give you this is not my expertise, right? Our expertise as far as Phoenix Sister Cities is establishing relationships. And so that's what we do. We establish a relationship. And then from a relationship, it opens up into whatever those parties want the relationship to become, whether it's universities is definitely economic development. Tourism is definitely economic development. One of my very favorites to tell you is Intel decided they were expanding into China. And they didn't establish a relationship in Chengdu, China, because of sister cities, but they were aware of it because of sister cities. And so checked it out, and they decided to build a facility there. And so the project manager discovered there was a sister city relationship. He came and talked to us, and then we started helping him make connections within the city of Chengdu for the various permits and all the logistics that he had to go through. He came back in 9 months and was absolutely thrilled. He said because of the connections that relationship was able to make for him, that he had saved about 2 to 3 years time.
Is this a way for Phoenix to sort of build its brand internationally and let, as much as, you know, Phoenix businesses
yes.
can learn about other cities, people in other parts of the world can also learn about Phoenix?
Yes. Yeah. Our Mayor Stanton and our city council are tremendously supportive of sister city relationships and the sister city program. And part of it is they see it as an economic development tool, of which it is. Another is to be able to serve the international community. It's amazing the cultural diversity in the city of Phoenix. And so we act as an enhancement. And there are people who can't travel but can still have an international experience through an organization such as Sister Cities.
Have you seen that the role of Sister Cities has evolved somewhat now that we have Google Earth? You know, we can learn
mm-hmm.
about pretty much any part of the world, can see pretty much any part
right.
of the world. It's a much more global world that we live in. It's not quite so insular anymore. So
right.
has the role and sort of the purpose of Sister Cities changed or evolved over that time?
Well, the purpose of Sister Cities, it was started by Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1956 as citizen diplomacy. And that is still a very important part of Sister Cities, is city diplomacy. But you're correct, because now as far as with the globalization, it's no longer country to country that is competing. I mean, it's gone all the way down to you have city to cities competing. And yes, so that role has changed to recognize it more as an economic development tool rather than just a cultural.
Paula West is president and CEO of Phoenix Sister Cities. Paula, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. In Valley traffic, The right lane on the 51 northbound is blocked at Cactus. You want to avoid that area if you can. Look for sunny skies for the rest of the day today with a high of 64 degrees. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows near 40. Sunny and 64 again tomorrow. More of the same right on through the beginning of the weekend. Sunny skies over Phoenix right now, 63 degrees at KJZZ at 250.
KJZZ is supported by ASU's Master of Liberal Studies, welcoming working adults back to the university. No GRE, no thesis, in person or online. More at asu.edu, keywords Master of Liberal Studies. Live to learn, learn to live.
Confluence. It's a coming together of people or things. And in the Heard Museum's Lincoln Gallery, that definition has come to life. The show's Anika Klein takes us inside an upcoming exhibit there called Confluence, Intergenerational Collaborations.
Seven teams of adult and teen artists from different Native tribes across the Southwest have brought their studios into the museum. The teams are working on fashion design, film editing, and metalsmithing, all while sandwiched between two huge murals being painted on the gallery walls.
My name is Jacqueline Russell.
Russell is the curator of Confluence. She says this diverse mix of tribes, art styles, and ages is exactly what she had in mind. It's reflective of the demographic shift happening in Indian country right now. It's getting younger. Percentages of people under 30 are at an all-time high, and Russell says she's concerned that young natives are becoming disconnected from their tribal roots.
It seems to me that there's more of a need now for there to be tools to be able to cultivate leadership skills and dialogue between those generations.
On one gallery wall, 17-year-old Ashley Craig is painting a mural with her artist mentor, Dwayne Manuel. She's adding brilliant red hues to a flower with a face on it.
This flower basically just represents like an individual finding clarity within itself.
Manuel stands on a ladder, sketching out red and blue lines that intersect one another and become purple.
I use a lot of my people's basket designs, and basketry is a cultural tradition.
Manuel is from the Salt River community, where basket weaving is a traditional art form.
And I started to incorporate the design with urban landscape.
The mural draws on Native influences, but it's not immediately recognizable as traditional Native artwork. And Jacqueline Russell says that's the idea.
That's where sometimes the public gets misconceptions, is not being able to place Native people in a contemporary context as people that, you know, wear hats, wear tennis shoes, work in spray paint, work in glass, work in, you know, every medium available to them.
So while Confluence is a mixture of many things, it's all Native, a term that artist Darlene Rainey Martin says is being redefined.
Nowadays, the younger generation are actually acknowledging who they are through fashion and art and music and all of that. So I think with us artists, we're just encouraging that step forward.
You can step into the Confluence exhibit at the Heard Museum starting on February 6th. It's the show. I'm Anika Klein.
Singer and songwriter David Rawlings has worked behind the scenes of the music industry for decades, most notably collaborating with folk singer and creative partner Gillian Welch. But his latest project, The Dave Rawlings Machine, has Rawlings front and center. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins spoke with him about his music and a new record with an obsolete sound.
I hit the weekend just like a freight. I got there early. I couldn't wait.
David Rawlings, your album is titled Nashville Obsolete. You use vintage analog equipment. The album cover is a tintype portrait that looks like something from the Civil War. You seem to revel in being of another time, and the music harkens to another time, yet it's still very much of this time. So I wonder, what's the key to making a contemporary folk or Americana album these days?
I guess I just make music that, you know, we make music we like. The title itself, Nashville Obsolete, for the album, had been a little joke phrase that we had said a lot because we have this old recording studio, and in the basement there's sort of an empty basement space that opens onto the street. And I thought we should put a little shop down there called Nashville Obsolete. And we thought, well, we'll just, you know, sell things that people don't really need anymore, which is, you know, things that we end up needing all the time. And so we had this phrase, and it seemed to attach to the material, which had a lot of the lyrics on this album talk about, you know, there's a lot of talking about sort of time and travel and sort of movement through life.
Whistles blow and people get on trains without knowing where they're going. Someone's daughter, someone's sister, someone's teacher going down the road.
And for some reason, the word obsolete connected to that. And because we've been so tied to Nashville for 20 years, we liked the way Nashville attached also. And a lot of people have looked at it and said, are you talking about, you know, the way Nashville music has changed? And it's like maybe 5% of that, and the way Nashville has changed as a city is part of it, and the way sometimes we just feel completely obsolete, you know. But the music itself and the songs themselves, they are what they are because of what we listen to and because of our love of the folk language and of folk songs and trying to include some of those feelings and themes. You know, you're being, a lot of times you're being symbolic in what you're saying, and hopefully you create a song that people connect to their own lives, that they can find something to attach to.
I once had your song Caleb Meyer stuck in my head for months, literally months. And it's a horrifying, haunting, dark song, but yet it's so beautiful and hypnotic. Why do you think we're drawn to darkness in music?
Well, I think music is, you know, particularly folk music, is really good at expressing a wide range of emotion, you know, where the music has one flavor and then the lyric has another flavor. And depending on what you're focusing on, it sort of is like a prism or something that you're looking at from different angles, and the light looks different inside, you know, depending on what you focus on or where you, what your vantage point is.
I won't get drunk no more, no more. The old refrain, it shines with use.
You mentioned the traveling theme that comes up in so much of your music. You've written songs like I Dream a Highway. On this album, there's The Trip. And in the song Pilgrim, you even sing the lyric, You Can't Go Home.
And where you gonna run? Tell me, where will you roam? When you can't go home, you
can't go home.
You can't go home,
you can't go home.
Oh, Pilgrim, you can't go home.
Do you think man is really a naturally restless creature?
Well, I think that artists are. Or rather, you know, the thing that I found interesting is, you know, at this point in our career, having known so many musicians and worked with so many people, you start to see the effect of change on people's art, which I find really interesting. And, you know, if you get in a situation where nothing is changing around you, it becomes harder. I've seen it become harder for a lot of people in my life also to create art that feels vibrant. And so I think that was something that was on our minds, was the fact that that need to move and to change seems to be part of keeping your eyes open in the world.
The Dave Rawlings Machine is making their first trip through Arizona. They'll be in Flagstaff tonight, Tucson tomorrow evening, and they'll be at the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts Thursday night. David Rawlings, it was a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time. I've had a great time.
Nothing obsolete about the man sitting across from me in the studio. Don't shudder like that. Doesn't help. KJZZ's Steve Goldstein, host of KJZZ's Here and Now, tomorrow morning at 11. Legislative session is now open, which means lots and lots of lobbyists down at the Capitol. You'll be talking about that tomorrow.
Yeah, Mark, there's a new book out called The Ethical Lobbyist, and some people might think that's an oxymoron. We'll talk to the author of that book and find out what people at the state capitol here think about the possibility of those words actually fitting together.
Also, Governor Ducey yesterday talked about water and trying to basically get some more folks at the Department of Water Resources. That'll be something you discuss tomorrow as well, right?
Right, and one of the phrases that stood out to a lot of people when he said that was more people at the Department of Water Resources is using existing dollars. People wonder how the magic might work in that as well.
And the big game is over. Alabama won the national championship last night, beating Clemson. But the discussion about such games, not over.
Well, a lot of folks might remember John Junker, Mark, who was in charge of the Fiesta Bowl, had a scandal end his career. Real interesting profile in Sports Illustrated this week about John Junker's sort of post-scandalous career. We'll talk to the writer tomorrow.
That's KJZZ's Here and Now tomorrow morning at 11. Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Mark.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Jimmy Jenkins and Sarah Ventry, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Regina Revazova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout and Domenico Nicosia are the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer. News director Al Macias. Our executive producer is John Hoban. This is member-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Mark Brody. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.